Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, Britain's defense minister in the United States, Ed Ferguson, discusses the United Kingdom's new integrated review and command paper. But joining us first is my good friend Byron Callan of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners to discuss the week ahead. Byron, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA, our land warfare coverage. So what's on your radar screen for the week?
Well, you know, despite Congress being out of session, really, I guess, till the 13th and the 14th, there's still a couple of think tank events. And, you know, there's always going to be the kind of news flow around the FY22 budget with President Biden's speech on the 31st and probably some of the skinny numbers coming out as well. And obviously the speech on the 31st is really going to focus on infrastructure, which is kind of a tangential interest to the defense sector. But I'll be looking for General McConville is speaking in CSIS on Tuesday, the 30th. The Army Chief of Staff are going to be talking about the Army's role in Indo-Pacific. There are some other events that people are probably going to have to catch the replay on. I know the Hill is doing a Future of Defense Summit on Monday afternoon. And there are some other smaller events as well. IISS is doing something on defense innovation in the UK that's taking place in London. You know, if you get up early, although I'm sure you can also listen to the replay on that too, that takes place on the 30th. But the main thing for me this week is going to be, again, the FY22 budget. You know, what can we divine from the skinny numbers that are put forth? There's also a meeting that obviously is not going to be public. It's been reported by Inside Defense on the 31st between senior DOD leadership and the main defense industry trade associations, most likely to talk about the FY22 budget. And I'm sure to also kind of corral support for what are going to be tough choices in that budget and in subsequent budgets as well. I think it's like, hey, please get on board. We're going to need your help with putting these changes through.
We talked a little bit about that budgetary dynamic on Friday's program, and Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute noted that Republicans are already ginning up at least the intellectual case for more money, you know, the expectation being that we're going to be around the $738 billion between 704 and 708 on the Pentagon side of that. Figure. You're also tracking SPACs, right? I mean, SPACs are sort of the hottest thing, raise money with no immediate purpose, unlike an IPO, right? You're sort of IPOing something quite vague so that you can do something with them. How are they changing the space and space in particular? No pun intended.
Yeah, I wrote there was another one that was announced last week. You know, and these are in effect capital injections into sectors that are not only adjacent to, but also addressing defense markets. And I think the space sector within defense has been one of the more vibrant ones. You know, I just keep calling this out. You know, anytime you see major capital infusion, it will stimulate innovation. You know, success can beget success. If other enterprises see a return on their investments. So, you know, it's good for national security, I think. It kind of pushes the needle further on, you know, getting more innovation back into national security. But, you know, it also may create some net challenges. There are heritage companies that could be impacted by some of these changes as well, too. So it's just something I keep calling out. And, you know, on my regular weekly note, you know, I looked at the size of some of these SPAC raises relative to, you know, the capital expenditures of the largest heritage companies, recognizing that, you know, these capital raises are not just going for capital expenditures, they're covering operating costs, but, you know, the numbers are significant.
And very quickly, you take on the notion of wasteful defense spending. Give us your thesis.
Well, it kind of goes back to the discussion on in the last call you guys all had on Friday, where, you know, the discussion in Washington, D.C. typically devolves into, you know, more or less defense spending. And what I was trying to say is, you know, there are other slices you could take at finding money for defense priorities. And kind of the four lenses that I put on were, one is kind of this notion of, it's a Kaizen principle, Muda, which is just waste and inefficient processes. You know, for all the talk, you know, DOD and Congress still don't seem to be able to get around to this. The other, and I don't think there's a good example of this today, is, you know, lengthy development programs that don't really result in anything. I can't think of something that's in the bigger than a breadbox category right now. There's money that's spent on systems or concepts that prove irrelevant to future warfare. You know, the one partially that's an example would be the Maginot Line, but, you know, the Convair B-58 supersonic bomber would be another one that you know, is kind of money down the drain in hindsight. And then the final thought of wasteful spending is when you use these very high-end assets for lower order missions. Now, I get that that provides some training and experience, but, you know, to a related concept that Air Force Chief of Staff General Brown talked about, you know, when you're using Ferraris to deliver pizza, you know, that's maybe not the necessary, he didn't use the pizza example, but he used Ferrari as a concept of our fifth generation fighters that, you know, in these lower order missions, you know, you can effectively waste your assets if you don't employ them in ways for what they were originally intended.
Myron, thanks very much for joining us. Hope you can join us on Friday as well. It's always a pleasure having you on. Thanks very much, and talk soon.
Thanks, Michael.
Last week, the Johnson administration unveiled its integrated review as well as its command white paper to reshape UK armed forces, retiring legacy systems like Tranche 1 Eurofighter combat aircraft, the Royal Air Force's entire fleet of C-130J Hercules transports, British Army equipment and manpower reductions are in order as well. The force will be cut to 72,000 from 80,000 currently to increase investment in a larger Royal Navy, better cyber and space capabilities, as well as investment in breakthrough technologies like artificial intelligence and quantum computing. In a dramatic shift, Britain also will increase its nuclear arsenal from 220 weapons to a maximum of 260 for the first time since the end of the Cold War. The documents also highlight the capabilities that Britain will need to return to its historic role as a Pacific power. Joining us now to discuss the changes and more is Edward Ferguson, the Minister for Defense at the British Embassy in Washington, who has had a distinguished career also serving as Her Majesty's Ambassador to Bosnia and Herzegovina, experience that has prepared him well for duty in today's Washington. Ed, welcome back to the program.
Okay, thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
Absolute honor having you on. Britain often leads in these kind of trade-off discussions. And we've seen that over the decade in strategic defense review after strategic defense review. There is a lot of talk in Washington now about the need to make these sorts of tectonic trade-offs, as British officials have explained to us, right? How do we take thoughtful risk now to de-risk for the future? What might be the most interesting or important elements for folks in Washington to be bearing in mind, right? What was the mindset, the mentality, and the approach the government used to make these trade-offs?
So I think there's a lot that doesn't change in the review. You know, our commitment to remain a leading player in NATO, the leading European nation in NATO, our commitment to, you know, high-end conventional warfighting capabilities to underpin that NATO collective security and deterrence role. But I think there are two things that are particularly kind of themes that run through this review. I think it's worth connecting this defense paper that we've produced to the integrated review that was published a week beforehand, which really sets out the UK's view of all of its international facing activities over the next 10 years, foreign policy, defense, security, and development. And, you know, I think what that does, the integrated review, is it essentially paints a picture of a more competitive world And it describes the UK's ambition to play a role as a problem-solving, burden-sharing nation in tackling the big challenges of the next decade or so in partnership with our allies, allies and partners around the world to ensure, essentially ensure the success of our model of open, free, and democratic societies in the face of growing competition. And I think that's important because that theme of competition carries through into the Defence Command paper. You know, as we look at the world, we see it is becoming more contested. And it's not just about our values, but, you know, the security spaces around us, whether that's in the Euro-Atlantic space or on the fringes of it, whether it's further afield in sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East and elsewhere. And right out into the Indo-Pacific now, you know, we are seeing challenges to the rules-based international system. We're seeing challenges to defense and security. And we're seeing other forms of threat, whether that's cyber, you know, right the way through to and disinformation, right the way through to organized crime. So, you know, in that contested environment, one of the themes of the Defense Command paper is that the armed forces need to play a more active role in competing and contesting where we see malign influence at play in those regions of the world that matter to us. So we're not trying to spread people right across the world, but in those areas that are really important to the United Kingdom. And you know, our integrated view is clear that our center of gravity will continue to be the Euro-Atlantic. But we're also going to tilt into the Indo-Pacific and seek to be more present there. In fact, it says we will seek to be the most engaged European nation by 2030. As well as engaging in those areas that matter in the Middle East and Africa and elsewhere. You know, in that context, how can we reshape the armed forces so that rather than essentially building an armed forces that it is designed purely for delivering conventional deterrence through the ability to do high-end war fighting, actually, if you want to compete and contest in those spaces about building resilience in vulnerable countries, around combating disinformation, around improving our understanding and our relationships and capacity building, you need slightly different skill sets, you need slightly different tools. And so they're part of the review is about reshaping and also increasing our overseas presence so that we are more present and we're not leaving spaces for others to fill. So I think that's a key theme. The other key theme is really around technology and you know the pace of technology change, which is a huge challenge for defense planners as we you know, seek to build our armed forces 10 years plus out. And what you see in this review is essentially the British government being prepared to take some hard choices, but also to put real money in place, you know, £24 billion extra over the next 4 years is a significant investment. It's a 14% increase in the UK's defense budget. So we are putting our money where our mouth is, and we are going after that modernization pretty aggressively across a whole range of areas, seeking to ensure that we are capable and meaningful in all the domains, whether that's maritime, land and air, or the newer domains of cyber, space, and also in the information and digital space in which we seek to integrate all of those other domains. So I think that's that sort of focus on competition and reshaping for competition, and that focus on modernization, ensuring that we are able to maintain pace, not just with our competitors, but also with close allies like the United States that are clearly spending enormous amounts of money, over $100 billion a year on research, development, testing, and evaluation, and allies need to keep pace with that.
How do you respond to some critics, though, who look at that and say, well, yeah, I mean, there is a £24 billion increase. There is a $16 billion. There's always a black hole, right? I mean, I think we always talk about the bow wave here in the United States. So I don't think it's a uniquely British phenomenon. How do you counter those who worry that this, Ed, is just another cut drill that is salami slicing in many ways, and will lack the fielding of those kind of capabilities UK forces will need for the future, right? I mean, there are those who say that the development goal of 0.7% has already dropped to 0.5% of GDP, which was an important metric that I think the Blair government had instituted, if memory serves correctly. Although I don't want to take anything away from the Cameron government. I can't remember which one of the two it was. At the end of the day, how do you respond to critics who say that at the end of the day, this is just leaving a smaller British military as opposed to one that's better suited for a globally more challenging and contested environment?
Well, I think if you look at the substance of the force structure that we are moving towards, then I think that argument kind of makes itself. I mean, so to give you an example, in the Royal Navy, We will have to, you know, we will retire some legacy platforms, including some Type 20, 23 frigates that are nearing the end of their lives, and they're expensive to run. So we will actually dip below our current numbers for a period in this decade. However, what we are doing actually is actually doubling our shipbuilding investment over the next few years to £1.7 billion a year. That is going to take us by the middle of next decade, we hope, to a considerably bigger fleet that is operating two aircraft carriers simultaneously, the only European nation that will do that. We're going to grow the number of frigates and destroyers to up to 24 from 19 today by the middle of the next decade. We're also investing in fleet solid support ships to support the carrier strike group, in multi-role ocean surveillance capability that will help us to defend undersea cables and the security of the Atlantic, which is a traditional and really important role for the United Kingdom. We're investing in new amphibious platforms and so on. So, you know, actually, the Royal Navy is a really good example of an area where, yes, there is some near-term pain, but actually, the long-term trajectory is one of growth. And, you know, another area is cyber, for example, where our new national cyber force is really building on the UK's, you know, real strengths. I think, you know, it is fair to say we are already a global power in cyber, thanks to GCHQ and our National Cyber Security Center and to our industrial base, which is significant and growing. But the new National Cyber Force that will bring together GCHQ, our Communications Intelligence Agency, with our armed forces and MI6 is a step change. It's going to be a significant amount of money going in. I think it's £5 to £6 billion over the next 4 years. Over the next decade, I think. But it's going to be, you know, it's going to be significantly enhancing our capabilities in offensive cyber. So yes, there is some pain, particularly in the kind of near term, to get where we need to be. But if we're going to be serious, and if we're going to take advantage of the advantage, you know, of the real opportunities in technology change, then I think this is the sort of place we need to be doing.
When it comes to investment, right? Talk to us a little bit about some of the capabilities that the UK is investing in, especially when it comes to long-range strike missile defense, right? I mean, two things where Britain has not had the kind of capabilities that will be necessary: hypersonics, especially as the UK increases its role in Asia. I didn't say it right at the top. I should have said you've remained a Pacific power, but clearly the government is looking to reinvigorate its Pacific role.
Yeah, well, just to kind of take that one first, perhaps. I mean, I don't think we would claim necessarily to be a Pacific power, but we do have, you know, interests in the Pacific, in the Indo-Pacific region. Actually, the integrated review that we published describes us as a European nation with global interests, and I think that's the best way of looking at this. You know, the UK's economy and trade, as well as our security and our values, are intimately bound up in the Indo-Pacific. It is going to be of vast importance over the coming decade. And we have a role to play there. We have some unique relationships. And really what we're looking to do is really strengthen those partnerships and play, you know, make a contribution in the interests of the sort of system of open, free, democratic societies and trade and economies and freedom of navigation, those sorts of interests which are really important to us. In terms of kind of investments, I mean, you know, kind of building on the technology theme, we're going to be putting about £6.6 billion, that's about $9 billion additional, into research and development over the next 4 years. And that will be in some of these, you know, cutting edge, new areas of technology, like directed energy weapons, like hypersonics that you mentioned, like anti-submarine warfare and others. Swarm technologies and so on. And we have some real strengths in our research base. We're doing some really exciting stuff in our laboratories. And what we want to do is advance that and pull it through into capability as quickly as we possibly can. You know, overall on you know, the threat and how that has changed, we have absolutely seen in recent experience, you know, look at some of the activities in Libya or Syria or Nagorno-Karabakh, that relatively cheap technologies like drone technologies can give you know, less sophisticated militaries an edge on the field. So we need to make sure that we are equipped to you know, counter those. So we are investing in the army, for example. We are investing in ground-based air defense in a way that we have not done for a while. We will also be investing in longer-range precision strike for the army. So, you know, that I think is a good example of where we will move to an army that is actually better protected to the sorts of threats that we see coming online, enabled by technology change.
Let me ask you about the nuclear arsenal.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of eyebrows went up, although I think folks can sort of understand some of the justifications of that. Russia developing a whole new generation of air defenses, same with the Chinese. If you're going to be resuming a broader Pacific role, for example, right, the nuclear calculus may be a little bit different. One British official who spoke to reporters suggested that the last administration had asked the UK to do more for, given that the UK nuclear umbrella, just like the US one, extends also, and just like the French one, extends to NATO as well. What are some of the deeper rationalizations, Ed, for getting to a larger nuclear arsenal? Because there are a lot of folks who are looking at this and saying, look, you know, obviously nuclear weapons are a cornerstone of international security, but this flies in the face, for example, of the non-proliferation agreement.
So I think let's
or
start
commitments, I should say, commitments.
Yeah, I mean, let's start with what hasn't changed. The UK has a minimum credible deterrent. And that has not changed. That is still what we aim for. I think it's fair to say that the focus of recent decades has been perhaps more on the minimum, and we've been driving down our numbers to the absolute lowest level. We're currently at around 225 warheads. We did have an ambition to reduce even further to 180 by the middle of the next decade. However, looking at this over the last year as we prepared for this review, and bear in mind this is about a decade since the last real scrub of this, it is absolutely, I think it is, you know, unarguable that the security and the nuclear security context has changed significantly. And you mentioned some of them there, you know, the changes in the Russian number of warheads, in the type and in the delivery systems that would enable them, in the defensive systems, as well as proliferation and growth of nuclear capabilities and arsenals in China, DPRK in Iran still there as an issue, and so on. So 10 years on, you know, I think if you have a minimum deterrent, in order to maintain credibility, inevitably you are going to have to be more flexible in responding to changes in the environment. So we've pushed it down to the minimum, but as the environment changes, therefore it follows logically that we need to adapt to that. That's a bit different if you're in the United States with over 5,000 warheads. You know, we have less than 5% right. of the warheads of the United States. So there is absolutely no change to our commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty here. We absolutely remain committed to moving towards a world free of nuclear weapons. And indeed, the UK, I think, has been leading a lot of that work amongst the P5 nuclear weapon states over recent years. And we will continue to do so. However, we need to maintain the credibility of our nuclear deterrent, as well as the minimum number of warheads that we need. And essentially, our judgment is that to reflect the changes in the security environment, we need to increase the cap. And it's worth saying, you know, the move from 225 to 260, it's about a 15% increase. We're not planning to have 260. We are giving ourselves the flexibility to adjust as we move into another decade where the trends don't look all that great. This is not that we hope to or want to do this. This is essentially a measured and reactive response to the security environment that we see changing around us. And I think, frankly, you know, I think the story here is more about how the security environment has changed than that the UK is changing. We are having to adapt to the security environment we see.
There is an evolution in how everybody is thinking about the threat, thinking about the challenge, increasingly focused on China, increasingly focused on Russia. But is there, Ed, a change in fundamental thinking that we have a tendency of believing in the West that we are the nations that have allies and partners, right? That it's something the United States has, it's something the United Kingdom has, it's something that France has. And we have a tendency of sort of underrating, you know, well, they're just partners of convenience. Well, partners of convenience, if you're China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and I dare say even some European governments, right, that may, right, I mean, Viktor Orban's name, for example, is mentioned in that list. Do we need to think fundamentally differently about how we think of the global security dynamic as opposed to thinking sort of by, you know, we have a tendency of thinking NATO, Russia, We don't have a tendency of thinking NATO, Russia, China. We have a tendency of thinking, and as the United Kingdom stands up and joins the United States in sanctions and pushing back, as we've seen, Beijing lashes out against everybody. And then you find the Russians sort of get involved in it too. I mean, do we need to fundamentally rethink how we think of the alliance threat landscape in maybe a different way than we've been thinking of them?
Yeah, I think we do. I think the, you know, the threat context is undoubtedly changing, and I think the response has to change to keep pace with it. I mean, I think it is, you know, I think a good example for that is NATO, which, you know, has not really thought about China very much at all, but increasingly, you know, is very much engaging with that agenda alongside thinking about Russia. You know, I think for me, I think that just that sense of the importance of allies and alliances and partnerships has become more and more pronounced over recent years. You know, it wasn't so long ago that what we call defense engagement, engaging with our allies and partners around the world, was a sort of what we called a discretionary activity for UK defense. When I was head of strategy at the MOD, we changed that to make it a core part of what we do. And I think this review has stepped that up even further to really think hard about how do we, you know, put more people overseas more of the time in the countries and regions we care about to really build those relationships, to, you know, significantly enhance our situational awareness and our understanding and our influence in those countries, to provide support where it's wanted, in building up capacity and strengthening resilience. And I think, you know, it kind of plays to the question we discussed about the industrial base. You know, we've got to think more cleverly about how do we use these partnerships, not just, you know, for the sake of relationships, but how do we use them to compete positively, but how do we compete in areas like technology? Our prime minister has talked about this construct called the D10, which is essentially an enhanced version of the G7 that would bring in countries like Republic of Korea or Japan. And, you know, I think those sorts of constructs, you know, wouldn't be suitable for everything perhaps, but those sorts of areas where we see real vulnerabilities in our supply chains, whether it's 5G technology, whether it's semiconductors, these are the sorts of things that we need to be talking about amongst our friends and allies. Because, you know, if we can only really compete and succeed together, and it is our unique advantage, I think that has become increasingly clear over recent years. It is what we have that others don't, is partnerships and alliances. So I think we need to get better at that. But we also need to become more structured and focused in how we use those partnerships to really ensure that we're able to maintain our competitive advantage.
Does the United Kingdom stay in Afghanistan if the United States decides to depart?
Well, I think we will make our decisions about Afghanistan, you know, with our partners. We went in together 20 years ago. We hope to come out, hope and intend to come out together. You know, the challenge at the moment is ensuring that we do that in a way that you know, maintains the stability and security of Afghanistan and doesn't allow Afghanistan to slip backwards. So that is a conversation that we will have with our closest allies and partners.
Let me take you to the question of industrial cooperation. We're in a neo-protectionist age, both in some terms good, in some terms bad, right? Biggest criticism of UK acquisition policy was it was predicated on sort of buying American systems at the expense of British capabilities and research and development. The paper notes the vital importance of building and maintaining indigenous capabilities. The United States is in a similar process on what sort of national indigenous industrial capability we need and sources of supply that go beyond what might be immediately considered defense articles. In this environment, Ed, what's going to be the relationship between the United Kingdom and its allies, the United States, including those in Europe and elsewhere around the world, in sort of satisfying these defense needs, right? The F-35 is sort of seen as an indicator, an important program for the United Kingdom. It's perceived as support declining for that program, for example, as domestic support for Tempest, the indigenous program, along with Italy and Sweden, goes up. What's the right way to balance these interests so that you don't get too by British, you don't get too by American at the end of the day?
I think it's exactly as you say, Vargo. It's about finding the right balance between these things. And I think, to start by putting this in context, I'm used to saying that we plan to buy £25 billion or $32 billion worth of US kit over the next decade. I haven't recalculated those numbers, but I don't think they've changed very much. Actually, if you look at the Defense Command paper, it confirms that we intend to buy more F-35s over and above the 48% that we've already contractually committed to. We also intend to buy new Chinook and Apache helicopters, protector drones. We're buying 9 P-8 maritime patrol aircraft from Boeing. We're buying an enormous amount of US equipment, and that will continue to be in our strategic interests, and it will continue to underpin the interoperability between our armed forces decades into the future. So that's really important, I think, to say up front. We did also publish this thing called the Defense and Security Industrial Strategy. And what that seeks to do is exactly to try and find the right, the sweet spot, if you like, the balance between those two things. This is not a buy British strategy. It's not a protectionist strategy. What it does do is it identifies certain industrial components where we do need to retain sovereign capability. Good examples. I mean, we talked about warheads, the ability to manufacture a warhead. We have to do that ourselves under the rules, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So we must maintain that capability indigenously. Similarly, on submarines, on offensive cyber, on cryptography. But essentially, that's a fairly small number of sectors where we must be entirely sovereign. There are other areas where we seek to retain operational independence, like in the combat air, in the maritime, in general munitions and complex weapons. Where again, we will seek to find the right balance. Beyond those areas, in general, actually what we seek to do is make it easier to collaborate with international partners. And I think this is really, really important as we look at that, more competitive technological space we talked about. We've already seen in issues like Huawei over the last 12 months or so, where we fail to collaborate across, like-minded Western nations, our competitors can get an advantage over us. So we need to find better mechanisms for doing that. We need to work on some of the barriers that get in our way where we want to collaborate, and it makes it slower. Whether that is, whether that is sort of political in terms of protectionist instincts that risk closing down the space of cooperation, sort of as a domestic challenge, or whether it is in terms of some of the constraints that we apply in order to protect our technologies legitimately from malign influence, whether that's about improving our screening of foreign direct investment, whether it's around protecting ourselves against IP theft. But we need to make sure that where we want to work with trusted partners, we can do that as cheaply, as quickly, as effectively as possible. And I think that is a real focus, or should be a real focus, for all of our countries going ahead. And also broadening, we do a lot bilaterally with the United States. We're also part of the US National Technology and Industrial Base with Canada and Australia. Those are really, I think, it's huge opportunities to develop those concepts. And it was very pleasing that Congress also seems keen to do that. But we also need to bring in other partners in the Indo-Pacific and in NATO. So finding the right mechanisms for that kind of collaboration remains really important. That's what we seek to do. But in the meantime, we will still be buying an enormous amount of brilliant American equipment. And I think British companies sustaining, 56,000 American jobs at the moment, which is, I think, a really important measure of how integrated our industrial bases already are and will remain.
Every nation needs to have indigenous capability to be able to make smart decisions, right? I mean, at the end of the day, that was always a criticism that, by you jeopardizing your engineering ability, it would make it difficult for you to be as good of a buyer as you are, to be a smart customer, effectively, exactly. I remember Bernard Gray and Lord Drayson talking about that, right? I mean, it wasn't protectionism. Yeah. At that point, it was very, very important for Britain to arrest the decline of its own indigenous capabilities, absent with which it would become very problematic. Let me take you to three very, very quick questions. One, 138 was the original F-35 number. There are folks who are beginning to regard this as, it'll be more than 48, but less than 138 as more investment goes to Tempest. Is the British commitment to the F-35 ironclad? Are we going to eventually see 138 jets with roundels on them?
So we haven't changed our aspiration to buy 138 jets over the life of the program. Of course, the life of the program is actually about 2070, isn't it? So that's a long period to go. We will continue to buy them at the right moment. And we haven't yet confirmed the numbers or the timings of the next tranche. We are investing in parallel in our own Future Combat Air System, sixth generation fighter. We'll be investing about £2 billion over the next 4 years in that. So we will need to look at these decisions in the round, but F-35 will remain an absolutely critical component of our combat air capability.
Obviously, industrially very important to the United Kingdom as well, given that you have more than 15% of the program goes to UK. Let me ask you one last question in the brief time we have. HMS Queen Elizabeth, flagship of the fleet, will embark later this year on its first deployment to Asia. In fact, India first, and then the Asia Pacific. It'll be carrying United States Marine Corps F-35 Bravo jets, as well as UK aircraft on it. Obviously, a lot of symbolism in this East of Suez deployment. Bring us up to speed on where the mechanics of it, how everything is coming together, and again, what's the message that this first deployment is delivering, not just regionally but globally?
I mean, the mechanics of this are extraordinary. I had no idea how complex this was going to be to integrate the air wing of another nation, the United States, onto one of our carriers. But, we have different platforms, different weapon systems, different rules of engagement, different health and safety. It's extraordinarily complicated. The fact that we've managed to get ourselves in a position where we are ready to embark on this extraordinarily ambitious maiden voyage for a maiden operational deployment for HMS Queen Elizabeth and her task force is, I think, just speaks to the extraordinary interoperability that we have between our two nations. The deployment itself is a deliberate statement of global reach. It's a deliberate statement of global ambition. It does speak to our ambition to become to tilt, as we say it, towards the Indo-Pacific, to become a meaningful player and to build and strengthen our partnerships in the Indo-Pacific region. But I think the very fact that we will be embarking with a U.S. Marine Corps F-35 squadron embarked with USS the Sullivans in the task force, for me, this is just a fantastic story about the extraordinary defense relationship between our two nations.
Thanks so very much for joining us. Absolute pleasure. Look forward to seeing you in person soon. And you're always welcome back on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Amelia Vargas. All the best.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.